Just an aside, this meeting is being recorded, so if you've got wonderful things to say, please do, but nasty things, we...
Send an email.
There you go. Okay. This afternoon, we're going to talk a little bit about trusts, irrevocable trusts, revocable trusts, and the use of life insurance in them, and basically, Pat and I are just going to have a conversation about it. And just the first thing to remember, trust and life insurance definitely go hand in hand. When we start talking about these topics, we're thinking about estate tax planning. We're thinking about asset and creditor protection for both the person creating the trust and for the beneficiaries of the trust. And we're also thinking about the control over the use of the assets. Sometimes they call it controlling it from the grave when you've got a client who is happy to give money away but desperately wants to be able to make sure that the beneficiaries use it for some good, that they just don't waste it.
So don't think of irrevocable life insurance trusts as just being used for estate tax exclusion, estate tax planning. That control factor can be very, very important. For example, with younger children, for irresponsible children, for grandkids, for special needs children, dependent parents. So the control factor can dictate that even a modest amount of life insurance might be placed in an irrevocable life insurance trust.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So let's start with some of the fundamentals of what I would call classic irrevocable life insurance trust planning, how it gets created and all that. And it's just the technical stuff, and we'll get past that pretty quickly. First thing is that you want a trust to be drafted by an attorney. Do not encourage your client to go on the internet and start downloading every sample form they see. These are complicated things. Even the simplest islet is a complicated document. So up, and here comes Peter Weinbaum joining us. Yay. We just got started, Peter. So first thing, get the trust drafted by an attorney, and also preferably, I would say, an attorney who knows what they're doing on estate planning. Not that a real estate attorney couldn't draft a life insurance trust, but it's not what they do. And there are so many changes in the rules and the laws. You want somebody who is specializing in it. Then, of course, that word irrevocable. Now, what do we mean by irrevocable when we're talking about an islet? Well, first, it generally means that the person who's creating it can't change it once it's created. And they also generally can't reach in and start taking money out and doing anything they want with it. What they've done is unchangeable as to them. But let me ask Pat, have you ever seen an irrevocable trust that can be changed, let's say by the trustee or by a beneficiary?
Or by a trust protector. I think the concept is more common in Europe right now, but the doctrine the idea of a trust protector is a third party, sort of like a super ego of the trust, an individual that can change trust provisions, trust beneficiaries. And so a trust protector might be someone to consider. And also just one recent, fairly recent development is the grantor now can replace the trustee as long as they can't replace the trustee with themselves or someone under their control. So we can build an awful lot of flexibility in, as Ellen indicates.
Yeah. So don't let that word irrevocable scare you or your client. Like Pat said, flexibility is the key here. And there are people who are watching over the trust to make sure it can be amended if circumstances change. So make sure you've got an attorney who knows how to do that. Next, of course, when we're putting the insurance into the trust, the ideal, not always happening, but the ideal is to have the insurance trust as the applicant, owner, and beneficiary from day one. That just eliminates any funny kind of estate tax issues. When I say funny kind of estate tax issues, I mean three-year rules on transfers. We'll talk about that in a second. But, of course, we don't live in an ideal world, and sometimes we can't get the trust to be the initial applicant and owner. So, and sometimes we have existing insurance that we want to move into the trust, usually for estate tax purposes. So just a couple of things to keep in mind. If you've got an existing policy, it's been in force a number of years, and you gift it to the trust, you've got a gift tax issue to look at. And just as a general rule, I'd say cash surrender value. I'm looking at Peter. He's shaking his head yes. Generally, we would value the contract at its cash surrender value. and that would be the amount that would show up on the gift tax return, which really should be filed when you're making this kind of a transfer. When you do that, you've got this thing called the three-year rule. If the insured dies within 3 years of the transfer, the death benefit will be includable in the estate. Now, there is one interesting way around that three-year rule, and that's if the insured is not the party who's transferring the policy. So let me give you an example. Let's say the policy was owned by the insured spouse, and the spouse transfers it into the trust. Well, you have a gift, but you do not have a three-year rule. So if you run into that situation and you want to talk it through, call Peter, Pat, or myself, and we'll walk you through it just to see if we can make the transfer without that trigger. And we'll give you our extensions at the end of the meeting.
Let me make one comment, which is, Zelen said generally it's the cash surrender value, but that's certainly true in most whole life policies. If you're talking about any kind of a universal life policy, it's really more like the reserve value or fair market value. The gift tax rules are worded a little bit differently than the income tax rules, but think more account value. In other words, without taking into account surrender charges. And if it's a no-lapse guarantee type contract, you probably won't even be able to determine the value without calling the insurance carrier and asking what the fair market value of the policy is, because neither cash surrender value nor account value is likely to be the real value for gift tax purposes.
And then one additional twist that some practitioners consider that in the first policy year of the contract, the value of the contract is premiums paid. But we leave that up to the client's advisor. We just may point that out as a possibility.
Great. A question to both Pat and Peter. Again, we don't live in an ideal world, and if the ideal world was the trust was in existence and it was the applicant, what happens when we're starting everything new and the trust isn't quite ready, but the app, we want to take the app? What's the strategy? How do we get past that issue of is it the chicken or the egg here? Is the app come first or what? Peter?
Well, I mean, from a practical standpoint, you're with a client. The client agrees it's a good idea. They want to do it. And by the way, the worst case scenario would be that you sat around waiting for 3 months for the trust to be drawn, and in the meantime, either the client died or became uninsurable. So the first, the most important thing is to get the coverage in force quickly. And if the trust is not ready yet, you try to get it done in a way that will make it the easiest and safest to get it in later. My first choice is always to have someone who has an insurable interest in the insureds somebody other than the insured himself or herself to be the applicant and initial owner of the policy. And then once once the trust is ready, the policy is issued, they can transfer it into the trust. If the trust gets done in a couple of weeks before the underwriting is complete, an amended application can be filed, and it will appear as though the trust was the original owner and applicant and owner of the policy. If the spouse is that person who does it, one thing to be careful of is that it is that the spouse not be a life income beneficiary of the trust. Otherwise, the proceeds will be out of the insured's estate, but they may come back into the wife's estate or the spouse's estate.
Sure.
There are other strategies too. For example, the three-year rule can be avoided if the trust is a so-called grantor trust and the insured sells the policy, or even the spouse sells the policy to a grantor trust. That's treated as a sale to the insured. The three-year rule doesn't operate, and so it's another way of doing it. There's a lot of complexities and a lot of situational issues that come up, and that's probably a good time to give Ellen or Pat or myself a call and just go over the facts of the particular case.
And one more procedural possibility is if your client, if you want to proceed with the underwriting, just take an application, leave the owner and beneficiary blank, take no money with the application, and then advise the underwriters in a cover letter that there's a trust being drafted. Do not issue the policy until we advise the trust is completed. Because even though you take the application, the key date is when the insurance is put in force, and in this case, the insurance will be put in force after the trust is effective. So that's another possible solution.
Yeah. Just keep in mind that if the insured dies or becomes uninsurable,
if
before the policy is in force, then... Again, you'd rather everybody would rather have 65% of the death benefit after estate taxes than have no death benefit at all. So it's important to get it in force.
Yeah. So once we have the trust drafted and the policy issued, obviously we need the premiums paid, and that's going to require the trust to get some money from someplace. So there are, I'd say, 2-3 classic methods of getting cash into these trusts, and first one is obviously a gift. And if we make a gift to a trust, we have to start thinking about, do we have any gift tax implications? Now, many of you may have heard the term crummy trusts when we're talking about irrevocable life insurance trusts. And crummy, spelled C-R-U-M-M-E-Y, is not a commentary. It's the name of an old case where we derive a lot of what we do in these gifting situations. The standard is that if we have the trust drafted correctly and it's got crummy language in it, when we make a gift to the trust and we try to qualify it for the annual exclusion, again, assuming all the details are right, that gift should qualify for the annual exclusion. Now, there are a whole bunch of rules and regulations and tons of case law that surround all the details of what makes a crummy language correct. We're not going to make you crazy about that today. But the key is that the trust has to let the beneficiary, for at least a period of time, have a right to touch the money that just moved into the trust. That creates this thing called the present interest, and with that, you can qualify for the annual exclusion. So right now, the annual exclusion is $13,000 per person, per beneficiary. And if you want to join with your spouse and do something called a split gift, it would be $26,000. Obviously, it's just doubled. So if you consider how many, let's call it crummy beneficiaries you have in the trust, it tells you very generally how much premium you can get in. So if you've got one Benny, you've got $26,000. Two, you have $52,000. Three, you might have $78,000, and you can keep doing the math from there. A couple of caveats to watch out for. If you're relying only on the annual exclusion and you're doing the split gift, so you're using the $26,000, if something happens to the marriage, if there's a divorce or a death, and you only end up with one person making the gifts in, the amount of money you're going to be able to put in is going to be reduced, and that could endanger some of your premium money. But, of course, that's only one way of getting money in. We've got something else called the exemption or the unified credit or the credit equivalent. You can Google all of that and get the same information. Pat, what's that number now? It's a nice big number.
The good news is it's $5 million per donor, so mom and dad or grandma and grandpa can put in a total of $10 million. That covers a multitude of sins in terms of funding life insurance trusts.
So if you're doing some planning now and maybe... We'll get to the butt in a second. If you've got the annual exclusion amounts and you know you need more premium than that, you'd be looking at the exemption. But
but it's only good for 2 years at this point. In fact, it's a year and a half. The rest of 2011 and then 2012, and then our buddies in Congress have to get together and agree on something after that. So we know that you can count on this $5 million exemption through 2012. We think you'll probably end up with it after that, but it's a way of encouraging clients to move, strike while the iron is hot, because even if that $5 million is reduced subsequently to $3 million. It's felt that gifts made under the $5 million will stand.
It would be hard to imagine them, even if they roll it back, giving you a penalty when they told you you could do it.
Right.
Yeah. And, of course, if you exceed the exemption and if you exceed your annual exclusion amounts, you would have a taxable gift. And right now that tax rate's 35%. And depending on what Congress does, it could stay there, it could go up, it could go down. We don't know. Okay, so one other way of getting money into an irrevocable trust that doesn't include gifts or doesn't involve gifts is through premium finance. Now, we're not intending to do a long conversation about premium finance here, but I want you to keep in mind that if we go to an outside lender, borrow the money, the trustee becomes the borrower of the money, we can use the grantor's outside cash, the assets, essentially to help guarantee collateral, because obviously the trust would usually only have the cash value of the policy. Sometimes that's just not enough to collateralize the loan. So premium finance can be a very gift tax efficient way of getting premium into a trust. A couple of things to watch out for. The older the client, the harder it gets to make these work. So if you're getting somebody over the age of 60, we might have a hard time designing plans that actually roll out the loan or do the things you want it to do or don't require huge collateral calls. So the greatest market is 60 or younger. If you've got that kind of a situation where you want to move large amounts of money into the trust and borrow it from a third party, what we'd also be looking for is a client with a net worth of at least $5 million and decent cash flow. So you can always call me or Dottie Vaudier or David Hayward to get some illustrations on that concept. But it does free up money for the client. It keeps us from using up gifts, the annual exclusion, and the exemptions. So just another way of getting money in there. Okay. So moving on to estate tax issues, when the time comes and our insured or insureds pass away and the death benefit is paid to the trust, the question becomes, is it out of the estate? And if everything has worked correctly, you don't have a three-year rule, you don't have the client reaching into the trust and using the money for their own purposes, they haven't retained any interests, the death benefit certainly should be outside of the trust. Now, when it gets paid out of the trust to the Bennies, I know, Pat, Peter, do we have any tax to pay when the money comes out to the Bennies?
Should not be. If it was income tax-free to the trust, it should be income tax-free to the beneficiaries.
Okay. So if you're hearing what Peter is saying, basically money coming out of the trust maintains its character. So if it's income tax-free in there, it's going to be income tax-free to the Benny.
Which is also a big plus for a high cash value contract, fully funded contract, because the trustee can take income tax-free loans against the contract, assuming it's a non-MEC, and they too retain their character when they're paid out to trust beneficiaries, so that's income tax-free cash flow to trust beneficiaries.
Yeah, and thinking a little bit more about cash flow, a lot of our contracts have the LIBOR rider or the ABRs, and we often get a question, can the trustee use that money to benefit the grantor if something happens and they need long-term care? And the answer is not directly. The trustee can certainly use the money and pay it out to the named beneficiaries, who may then choose to use the money to help mom and dad or whoever the grantor is, but we certainly can't get it back directly. Any other thoughts about how we can make that work for clients who like to give it away but keep it?
Yeah, there is one other way of doing that, and that is just as the way that that an ILIT is used to, quote, pay estate taxes is generally to give the trustee the power to use the insurance proceeds to buy assets from the estate or make loans to the estate.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing could happen with accelerated benefits. The trustee can make loans at a market rate of interest to the grantor or the grantor's spouse, or can purchase assets that they own to provide cash for that purpose.
Okay. Great idea. Hey, I'm going to be asking Peter and Pat just a couple of sort of case study scenarios for the next few minutes, just to help position some of what we just talked about. Let's think about a fairly straightforward case study. Mom and dad, let's say they have three kids. Let's say dad owns a business, and only one of the children is active in the business. Fairly standard scenario. Family business, but the whole family's not involved. And let's say we're not in an estate tax situation. Let's say the estate's $5 million or less. And the other piece of that is also, let's assume that the business actually makes up a large portion of the estate. So that if, when you're sitting and doing your estate planning, and it's not estate tax planning, but just estate planning, and the client says to you, well, I want to make sure my son who's in the business gets the business, but I want to make sure my spouse and the other two kids are taken care of. How can we use life insurance and trusts to get them where they want to go?
Well, go ahead, Pat.
Okay. I was going to say we could create an asset to provide equitable treatment for the kids that aren't active in the business. It doesn't have to be, and notice we said equitable, not equal. It doesn't have to be the same amount. So, for example, we could take out $2 million worth of insurance, probably hold it in trust because, again, that control issue, we don't want the kids to hurt themselves. But we have the $2 million in the trust for the benefit of the kids that aren't active in the business. That way they each get $1 million income tax-free from life insurance proceeds, and the son who's active in the business gets control over the business. Now, even though the business is worth $3.5 million, that son's going to have to work pretty hard to make that business work, and the other two kids should be perfectly happy with $1 million income tax-free.
Classic planning.
By the way, another way of doing that is actually to, depending on the values, is to have a buy-sell arrangement between the kid in the business and the parents. And so when the parent dies, let's say dad dies, son buys the business from dad, and that puts money in the estate that can be used for the spouse and also to equalize the inheritance for the kids. So.
Great. A couple of different ways to handle family businesses and getting what, and I'll put it in quotes, getting a fair distribution to each of the kids and to the spouse. Okay, a slightly different set of facts. Say you have a client who is not married, either divorced or widowed or just simply has never been married and has a couple of children. And let's also assume that this client is in an estate tax situation worth $10, $20 million. Let's also assume that the money he's got, he's putting to work every day. Hedge fund manager, business planner, real estate guy, taking that cash, putting it in, turning it over, earning 10-15% in every transaction, and needs to have liquidity present. That's the kind of client who, when you suggest to them that they should have life insurance to protect against the massive losses that their estate is facing, if the estate, when considering that the estate tax right now would take 35% over every dollar over $5 million. And if he's in a state like New York, you could add another 15-16% on top of that. This is a client who might acknowledge the need and how smart it would be to leverage their money, but just don't want to take money off the table to do it. Now, before I mention premium finance, and I'm looking at Peter, and he's going, oh, you know. But it's what I've just described is a classic scenario, and I'm going to give my colleagues here an opportunity to talk about how to do that classic scenario.
Okay. Yeah, a couple things. Premium financing is an attractive scenario here. Another thing to consider, and we don't know all the facts of the case, but if we've got a C corporation, a separate checkbook, we might do split dollar to fund it. That gives the business a receivable for the amount of premiums advanced, so he's not really losing the money. And then the last thing is private split dollar. You can make loans to your trust, or some wealthy family member can make loans to the trust at a market rate of interest. So there's three different variations depending on where you get the funds. Premium financing, you go to a bank. Split dollar, you go to the business. And private split dollar, you go to the family. So I think they're all variations on a loan theme here.
Okay.
And although I don't believe in trying to argue the client out of his or her position on things, let's say this client got a $20 million estate. It's wonderful that this client can earn 15% on his money, but if the client succeeds in tripling their estate by the time they die, they've just been working for the government for a long time. So with some small piece of his or her assets, having an estate tax free accumulation, even though it isn't as appealing on a yield basis, it probably makes more sense than taking risks to get 15%, where at least a third, and maybe, you know, probably at least 40% of it is going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And so that brings to mind also that some of the other techniques we use might be estate freeze devices. We might convert the business to a family limited partnership and give away limited partnership interests. We might gift it to charitable maintenance trust and have it, you know, pay out over our lifetime, and thereby sell it off through the charitable maintenance trust and avoid capital gains tax. There are a lot of other estate freeze devices we could use to limit the growth in the estate, because as Peter mentioned, I mean that's pretty onerous if you triple your estate and you're losing 35%. You know, unless your client's totally irrational, that's not really a wise planning move.
But we never have irrational.
No.
Okay. Two last quick case studies, and then we'll open it up for questions. Another classic use is to help with families with special needs children. A situation close to my own heart, and probably if you looked around in your own lives, you would be able to see many families who do have special needs children. And you often have a mom and dad and a number of children, and one of the children has special needs. And whether they're rich or poor, there is always a desire to be able to make sure that that special needs child is going to be taken care of. With that just general thought in mind, let me again look to Pat and Peter and get your thoughts on using life insurance inside a trust for the special needs child.
Yeah, well, it's a perfect scenario. If they're in an estate tax type situation, then the irrevocable trust makes sense, and it's not a standard off the shelf irrevocable life insurance trust. It's usually called a special needs trust, and often it takes into account that the child may be receiving government benefits, and they would like those benefits to continue. So the trust is some sort of a discretionary trust where the trustee has plenty of assets through a life insurance policy to make gifts or cover certain expenses at their discretion and in a way that doesn't interfere with government benefits. If it's not an estate tax situation, it's certainly perfectly acceptable to have the clients own the policy themselves and name the special needs trust as a beneficiary of the life insurance. And typically the way it's set up is to take care of the child, and then when that child passes away, to then have whatever is left go to other children or other beneficiaries.
Mm-hmm. And you can certainly buy or place enough insurance to provide an inheritance to the non-special needs children in addition to the special needs child.
Which is why survivorship insurance, for example, our SIUL contract, would be very attractive here, because for a given premium, you get the most death benefit, or for a target death benefit, you get the lowest possible premium. So make maximum use of leverage and use a survivorship contract where appropriate.
Okay. Okay, one last set of facts, and this will not involve an irrevocable trust. Let's say you have a client, and I'm gonna couch it in the terms of a single mom with a couple of minor children, 2 years old, 5 years old, just younger than majority, and mom is gonna buy life insurance, and she wants to name those children beneficiaries. Of course, there is a legal problem in naming a minor a beneficiary. So how can we, by using a trust perhaps, avoid those legal issues?
Well, if you name a trust, then the trust is not a minor. And so That's the easy way. I mean, that's that's sort of the fail-safe way. Important to make sure that they select appropriate trustees and have the right provisions in it. But it could be a trust that certainly pays money for the benefit of the two kids, and then at some point in time, maybe when the trustee feels that they're old enough and mature enough to distribute what's left to them. Mm-hmm. I would imagine you can do this with custodial accounts. You can have an UTMA, usually most states are UTMA now, account, and the only caveat about that is, I mean, the good thing is it less cost than a trust. The not so good thing is that you usually have to turn it over to the kids at age 18. So recommend the trust. It doesn't require a particularly unusual trust. It shouldn't be very expensive. And I suppose if single mom can afford premiums for the life policy, can probably afford a little bit more to pay an attorney to get a trust done.
And these trusts are usually revocable trusts, so they can be changed at any time and any way.
Yeah, and typically a revocable trust becomes irrevocable when the individual dies, the grantor dies. So in this case, the policy could be owned by mom and payable to a revocable trust just to control the payout of the proceeds.
Yeah.
Because a revocable trust is sort of disregarded for income tax purposes, so there's no point in having it owned by the revocable trust, but having that revocable trust as the beneficiary at death when it becomes irrevocable would be a great way to control the proceeds going out to the kids.
So those are just a few case studies designed really to trigger any kind of thoughts. Take a look at your cases, the people that you know, the files in your file cabinet of people that you've talked to over the years. If any of these set of facts sounds familiar to you, pull those out, give us a call, we'll walk through them with you. And right now I'm going to unmute and open this up for questions, so hold on a sec.
All attendees have been unmuted.
So, any questions, please shout them out.
Hello?
Hello, yes.
Hello. Just a quick question on the trust. Now, would that be a testamentary trust that you were just talking about? You just set it up in the will,
This would be a revocable trust. It's a document that exists while the person's alive. The only reason we don't set it up in a testamentary trust is now you've got probate, and you've got a way for the will to go through probate, and then the insurance would move into it. This way, it happens pretty much immediately.
Okay, that makes sense. So you don't do the testamentary trust because it goes through probate.
Right.
So you just do a revocable trust, and then it's done.
Exactly.
Okay. And on the ABR stuff, there is special wording needed in the trust to allow the trustee to distribute cash on the behalf, or to the beneficiaries who can, and then in return send it back to the donor.
We recommend special language. It's possible that a trust will have broad enough language to permit it. For example, let's say that they're just a normal irrevocable trust. Many of them say that at any time the trustee has discretion to distribute income or principal to any one or more of the beneficiaries. Okay, so. And also general powers to sell assets and buy assets and so forth. So they usually have a general power to exercise all ownership rights under a life insurance policy. You put those all together, and that could work. If you're drafting a trust from the get-go, and you know that there's going to be a policy with accelerated benefits riders, then it makes a lot of sense to include special language that gives the trustee the right to accelerate benefits for chronic illness, for example, gives them a right to make distributions to beneficiaries or purchase assets from the grantor or the grantor's spouse. And we have samples of that language to provide to an attorney who's working on a trust in case they'd like to incorporate that into their document.
Excellent. And then my last question on the $5 million exemption. So literally right now and next year, they can give away up to $5 million of their estate. With the rules. And then who knows what's going to happen in 2013.
Exactly.
But in the past, it was decoupled. Is that what they called it? So they couldn't give away the whole estate tax.
They could only give away. There was a $1 million lifetime gifting exemption, and then whatever the estate tax exemption was, that it was also part of the estate tax exemption. So, for example, in 2009, there was a $3.5 million estate tax exemption. $1 million out of the $3.5 million could be gifted away during life, and then you'd have $2.5 million left if you used it during life. Now it's $5 million per person or $10 million for a couple, and you can use all five or ten during your lifetime and save nothing for the estate tax.
Okay, so if you give $5 million away this year, then you don't have any more, under the rules right now, any more estate
exemption.
Exemption.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Okay. But the concept of giving it away now would be that it's $5 million and that it may go down.
Well, yes, not only that, that's a big one. And in addition to that, $5 million given away today, unless you invested foolishly in the stock market, probably going to be worth more than $5 million several years from now. So
it's kind of an estate freese technique.
Yeah, you're
taking advantage of what it is.
The growth out of these.
Yeah.
Okay. And nobody has the crystal ball of what's going to happen in 2013. Do you have a feel? Or are you done giving up on what they might have?
I have an opinion on everything. I have an opinion on everything, but I would assume it would be a very tough sell to try to cut those back dramatically for either party once there are $5 million. Now, there may be some negotiating over, you know, the exact number. There may be some negotiating over the exact final rate, but I would guess that they'd be hard-pressed to lower the exemption and increase the rate significantly.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
A pleasure. Any other questions?
Yeah, in context with the new life income rider and your conversation today regarding trust, could you all offer some comments?
On the...
Well, just the applicability.
With the life income, is that
life
the liver?
Income benefit rider.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does it make sense or...
Well, I mean, I don't think it'll be your normal situation in that if you're talking about an ILIT, typically the policy is on an individual and it's going to pay out income basically for retirement purposes, where generally when you put a policy in the irrevocable trust, it's to pay a death benefit for various purposes that Ellen talked about today. So I would say I guess the comment that I will make is I see sometimes agents trying to make a policy do two or three things. You know, let's sell a policy, we'll keep it out of the estate, we'll have income for retirement, we'll avoid creditors. I mean, you know, three or four things, and I recommend generally that you divvy it up. Say, okay, how much do we need for retirement? And if we need money for retirement, let's have a policy that's personally owned. You stuff it full of cash. You have it available for retirement. If things change in the future and you don't need it and you want to get it out of the estate, you gift it to a trust. And now let's take the amount that you really, really need outside your estate and probably fund it more conservatively and put it in the irrevocable trust, but don't expect it to generate income for yourself. Is that responsive to your question?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
I was thinking of the situation, but you said something that clarifies that, where you have a beneficiary who you want to guarantee that a certain amount of income, case paid to that beneficiary as a needs case.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the trustee can be, I mean, the trustee could be instructed to do that even with the death benefit.
Sure. I mean, for one thing, you can use a settlement option or purchase a SPIA, you know, after the death of the insured.
The trustee can do that.
Right.
Okay.
Other questions?
Thank you.
If a trust existence now and they purchase life insurance and transfer it in, does a three-year rule apply?
Three-year rule applies any place it applies. In other words, if I'm the insured and I transfer a policy to a trust for less than its full value, then I have to live for 3 years or the proceeds will be in my estate. Doesn't matter whether the policy was in existence before, whether I buy it now and then transfer it. If the insured transfers the policy for less than full consideration within 3 years of death, it'll be in their estate.
So in your case, you'd want to have the trust buy the policy from day one.
So if the trust buys the policy, we just ask, is that... it's still inclusive in the estate if it's within 3 years?
Yeah. If the trust buys the policy for its fair value, then you will not have a three-year rule.
And if the trust buys a new policy with cash that's been given to the trust, there's no three-year rule.
Okay. And the fair value, meaning the cash value or the... What do you mean by the fair value?
Well, it's called fair market value, and each policy type... has its own, there can be a different way of determining what the fair market value is of different policies. So as Pat mentioned, the fair market value of a policy in its first year is typically the first year premium. The fair market value of a term policy is typically its unearned premium. The fair market value of a no-lapse guarantee UL product is something that actuaries have to tell you, because it doesn't show up on the illustration. The fair market value of a UL policy is typically the accumulated value. The fair market value of a whole life policy that's been in place for 10 years or so is typically the cash surrender value.
And the fair market value of a policy where the insured is terminally ill is very close to the death benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't use this technique to get proceeds out of the estate necessarily.
Well, it sounds like the best way to set this up would be gifting to the islet. And if they give to the islet purchases the policy, then it's free.
Right.
Perfect.
That's the ideal. That's what you want to head to, for sure. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Two.
Yeah. Most of this, I've been in the insurance business for about 20 some years, and most of these topics are way over my head. I don't even know how to answer a question, but. I'm trying to learn enough because I know I've got some clients who fit this stuff, and one is wondering if there's some type of material you have I could read to get me at least smart enough to have an intelligent conversation. And obviously, I need to get in touch with you guys to help me along the way. But it's tough to even get into a conversation with a client.
Absolutely. The best way would be to call either myself or Peter or Pat. My extension is 3310.
Pat Lang, my extension is 7361.
And Peter is 3310. Peter Weinbaum is
3954.
Okay. So you can call any one of us. You can email us. We'll walk you through it. We'll direct you to material. We'll help you figure it out.
Okay, could you repeat one of those? I didn't have my ink pen handy.
Okay, my Ellen Lamer, that's my extension's 3310. Just give me a call.
All right.
Okay.
And call the National Life Group basic phone number?
Yeah, 802-22.
I don't know. But the sales desk can help you find documents also.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Or they could always just send you to us too if you call to them.
You say the word trust, and they know where to go, right?
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Find a.
All right. So we're good. We really thank you for calling in, and again, give us a call, and have a great day.
Thank you.